Every Woman is a feminist show about women and girls making a difference and the men who support us. As 50% of humanity and 53% of eligible U.S. voters, women are not a special interest group, and every woman should work and vote toward nothing less than 50-50 participation in the social, political, economic, and environmental arenas. The views and opinions expressed on Every Woman are those of the hosts and guests and do not necessarily represent those of Midcoast Radio Project Incorporated, KKFI, staff, volunteers, board, or management.
Hello and welcome to Every Woman. I'm Fiona Nowling and I'm here in the studio today with Una Nowling, my wife and engineer for the day.
Hello.
And Sharon Lockhart. And also with me I have Ember Urbach and a new co-host, Janie Davis, who's here today for the first time. And I'm going to lead us in with some of the feminist news of the week and then pass it over to Ember for a little bit more news. So we're starting off with the news that John Oliver has criticized the Academy for keeping Bill Cosby and Roman Polanski after expelling Harvey Weinstein, and he's got a point. In the wake of the shocking announcements about Harvey Weinstein, where the only shocking thing was how many men claimed they were ignorant of it, and shocked they were to find gambling in Rick's bar. Sorry, no, that's sexual harassment in Hollywood, my mistake. It has been pointed out that there's a lot of other open secrets being ignored there too. The only good thing about this event with Harvey Weinstein is that it has inspired the Me Too hashtag, where Alyssa Milano encouraged people to post Me Too if they had experienced sexual harassment or sexual assault. Tons of women and some men have been sharing the Me Too hashtag on Facebook, Twitter, and other social media platforms, and some have been sharing their stories and some just the tag, and people have been surprised at the numbers. Well, when I say people, I generally mean men, I'm afraid to say. I know we say at the start of the show that this is a show for women and the men who support us, but generally speaking, it is the men who are oblivious to sexual harassment and to the number and amount and the depths of it. So there are lots of articles at the moment explaining how common it is, how women shouldn't have to bear the emotional burden and the labor of having to relive their bad experiences so that men can realize how bad it is, in addition to also having to endure those experiences all their lives too. In addition to that, the Me Too idea was invented before hashtags even existed by a woman of color, Tarana Burke, as a way to support other women and other victims. It was a catchphrase to be used from survivor to survivor to let folks know that they were not alone and that a movement for radical healing was happening and possible, she said in an interview this week. And it was created to help people. And so, especially with this dragging up people's memories and with it being Domestic Violence Week, if you need help, you need to know that you can call the National Sexual Assault Telephone Hotline at 1-800-656-4673 or text the Crisis Text Line at 741-741. Meanwhile, in a sublime to the ridiculous moment, the fight for gender equality has reached Thomas the Tank Engine. Presumably spurred by a drop in toy sales rather than any real belief that girls are actually as good as boys, but they realise that their parents' money spends just the same, Mattel is going to add two new female characters to the Thomas and Friends series next year. And they're not adding them as silly, whiny, slow caboose cars, they're actually going to be new engines. And they're going to have girls in the adverts for the toys too.
Please tell me they're not going to be pink.
I sincerely hope not. They are actually giving wider representation than just to girls, because one of the engines, Nia, is an engine from Kenya, and they have consulted with people from Kenya to ensure that they get an appropriate design on her engine, and represent African art and intellect appropriately. The other engine is called Rebecca, and she's an engine from Thomas's fictional world near the island of Sodor, which is now making me think of Game of Thrones and Hodor. So, better put some snow scoops on Thomas. Winter is coming. But Bernie Sanders is going somewhere a lot warmer. No, it's not hell. It's Puerto Rico. And whilst that comment was originally prompted by the "you may all go to hell and I will go to Texas" quote, the conditions in Puerto Rico still aren't improved any after the hurricane and the complete lack of help from the mainland US. But The issue with Bernie Sanders at the moment is it was announced last week that he would be giving the opening night speech at the Women's Convention on October the 27th, which is also my birthday. Also important news.
Oh, now, if that isn't a plug, I don't know what is.
It's okay. I didn't do a call for action for anyone to send birthday gifts into the station for me. So, this Women's Convention is organized by the very people that created the Women's March and whose event slogan is Reclaiming Our Time. And so there was a lot of backlash about it. One quote read was, "What I would prefer to do with my reclaimed time is not hand it over to a man so he can offer up his thoughts on my lived experience." Another said, "To have a man open a women's convention is absolutely a disgrace. I'm embarrassed for you." I think that encapsulates it perfectly. Even ignoring the fact that Sanders has campaigned with anti-choice Democrats and has dismissed issues such as gay rights and abortion as social issues less important than economic ones. Oblivious to the fact that the right to contraception and abortion is an economic issue, as is gay rights. If you can be fired for being gay or for using contraception, that's an economic issue, plain and simple. The organizers apologized for people's reactions and said he wasn't the keynote speaker, just the opening speaker, which sounds like one of those, "I'm sorry that you're offended by my actions," rather than "I'm sorry about my actions."
You know, there's not a whole lot of difference between opening and keynote speaker, and I say that making a plug for myself because I've been both of them.
Yes, you have. I think we're going to have to compare size of plugs later.
Oh, wow.
The organizers did say that the most important women in politics were unfortunately too busy to come. Conveniently enough, though, since then, Sanders has issued a statement apologizing for ditching them, but due to the emergency in Puerto Rico, he'll be traveling there to try and find ways to help the island, which is something I think we can all get behind. And now, while we're talking about plugs, I will do a quick plug for an event happening in Lawrence next week on October 28th. JOCO Move On is organizing an event in Lawrence, forgetting that it's not actually in Johnson County, but it's got a really cool name. It's Resist Tricks and Tweets Dump Trump. And that's happening next Saturday from 12 p.m. till 3 p.m. in South Park in Lawrence. And I'm going to hand over now to Ember to continue the news.
There is a new study by the U.S. Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, which is the government agency responsible for processing sexual harassment complaints. And through that report, they said that nearly one-third of the 90,000 complaints received in 2015 included harassment allegations, but they noted that the number is far too low to reflect the reality of how many sexual harassment claims there are that go unreported. They also estimated that about 75% of all workplace harassment incidents go unreported altogether. And in 2016, they released a comprehensive study of workplace harassment in the United States, which concluded that anywhere from 25 to 85% of women report having experienced sexual harassment in the workplace. And of those women, 75% of employees who spoke out against workplace mistreatment faced some form of retaliation. In New York City, a bill was passed aimed at increasing workplace safety. And it included provisions to allow the use of sick time for individuals who are experiencing domestic violence. This would allow victims to use time off for court dates, doctor's visits, advocacy meetings, mental health services, and other needs. And this includes services for themselves or for family members. This is a step in the right direction to help make sure that women who are victims of violence don't lose their jobs through, just having to get help for themselves and for their families.
And while we're on that note, very appropriately today for Domestic Violence Week, we actually have with us on the phone Alicia Cassano-Weisenbach, who is the Director of Volunteer Services at the Willow Domestic Violence Center in Lawrence.
Hi.
It's good to hear from you.
Yes, thanks for having me on.
Can you tell us, our listeners, a little bit about the shelter and what services you provide, and also how did you get involved with helping there?
Yeah, absolutely. So a little bit about us. We have a 30-bed emergency shelter. We serve three counties. So we serve Douglas, Jefferson, and Franklin counties. We also offer services to survivors of human trafficking, in addition to survivors of domestic violence. And then we have a number of community outreach services as well, like court advocacy, employment services, things like that, to help people get to a place of safety and stability. And we also serve survivors of all gender identities as well. So we're fully integrated. And a little bit about how I got involved. I actually started out as a volunteer. It's been over 4 years now. And then I worked for about 3 years doing direct service in our shelter. And so I just recently took this position. And so now I get to train new advocates about how to work with survivors.
That's excellent. So in your services, what kind of things are your volunteers doing to support the shelter and the services that you all provide?
Yeah, so I think that our volunteers get a really unique opportunity. They're not just kind of doing, you know, side work or, you know, things that maybe the staff doesn't want to do. They're actually able to provide peer counseling to survivors within the shelter and in those community programs I mentioned. You know, they answer our crisis hotlines. They do a lot of the same work that our staff does. And so in that way, I think they get a really meaningful volunteer experience.
If someone wanted to become a volunteer and help out with you, how would they get in touch with you and get involved?
Yeah, so I'm the point of contact for that. So we have a volunteer application on our website, which is willowdvcenter.org, and then that has all the contact information as well.
So are you having any special events or any outreach and awareness this week for Domestic Violence Week?
Yes, actually, so we've been doing things all month because, as you know, it's Domestic Violence Awareness Month. And so lots of presentations. And then next week, actually, on the 26th in South Park in Lawrence, which I know you just mentioned because there's another event going on that week. But the 26th, South Park, Lawrence, Kansas, we're having a memorial from 6 p.m. to 8 p.m., just kind of a candlelight remembrance for everyone we've lost this year due to domestic violence.
How many, is that in Lawrence or in the three counties? How many women have been lost due to domestic violence?
Well, just recently, actually within the past few months, there was a pretty highly publicized incident. There was a woman, Erin Berg, and her young child, who were murdered by her former partner, and then he then killed himself.
So we heard about Erin Berg and her daughter in the media, and something that has always interested me, and I'm new to doing anything on the radio, but is the role of the media in reporting domestic violence.
Yeah.
A lot of times we'll hear that it was a lover's quarrel or a domestic dispute, but it ends in murder. And
yeah.
So, I mean, what are your feelings or thoughts about how the media reports domestic violence and what role they have in you know, getting across the seriousness of these incidents?
Yeah, that's a great question. So in this really recent case with Erin Berg, I was actually really impressed by the way the local media handled it. They spoke to her family. They did talk pretty openly about the fact that it was domestic violence related. So I thought that was a really positive thing in a horribly tragic circumstance because, you know, normally, you're right. You do see that media kind of tries to disguise when things are domestic violence related. And I think that that is a real shame because these kinds of things, this type of interpersonal violence really does thrive in silence. And then I also think it makes victims feel really alone, like they're the only ones who are experiencing these things. And then additionally, it makes it so that maybe people that aren't as familiar with the issue of domestic violence don't necessarily take it as seriously. They're not looking at it as the potentially lethal situation that it is. And the most frequent thing I think that you hear is you do hear a lot about sort of murder suicides, or somebody, typically a man, in this kind of case, who murders his family and then himself, but there's really no mention of domestic violence. And from what we know about those situations, those are pretty much always domestic violence.
What would you advise someone to do as a bystander? Because when I was growing up, the house I lived in, the people next door, we could hear rows all the times, and frequently the woman from the house would have a black eye. I mean, I was a kid, so I wouldn't really have known what to do about it, but what would you recommend people do when they know that?
So I think particularly if there's a violent incident occurring, in terms of physical violence, you know, you hear noises or anything, definitely call 911. Don't try to get involved yourself. That can be incredibly dangerous, not only for you as the person trying to get involved, but also, you know, possibly for the victim as well, that you don't know how the victim's abuser is going to react. That might make them more angry. So definitely call law enforcement if that kind of situation arrives. And then in terms of if it's someone in your personal life that you know and they're going through a violent relationship, I think the most important thing to do is just believe them. Believe the things that they're telling you, because their abuser has probably made them feel as though they're crazy. And they may have even told other people or family members that their survivor or the victim in the situation is crazy to discredit them. So believe that survivor. Don't try to give them directives or tell them, well, you just need to get out of there. I think that's a really common instinct because, you know, especially when you care about someone, you don't want to see them, you know, in a bad situation or experiencing violence. But the most dangerous time for a survivor of violence is typically that first 2 to 3 months after they leave. That's when they're most likely to be murdered. So I would just say, you know, don't tell the survivor what to do. Just believe them. Tell them that you're there for them if they need you. You can make yourself familiar with whatever local services there are in your area. Every county in Kansas is covered by a domestic violence center and by a sexual assault center. So making yourself familiar, being able to give those resources to people, I think those are all good ways to support survivors.
Alicia, can you talk about how do women get into situations where they are domestically or abused and, and may not recognize it, the symptoms or the signs?
So I think that for a lot of people, you know, you mentioned those symptoms or those signs. We usually refer to them as red flags, but you know, I think the way a lot of people end up in a violent relationship is that, you know, they're not taught, one, to look out for those signs. So it's not their fault by any means. It is the fault of the person perpetrating the abuse. I think, you know, I, for instance, I didn't know anything about red flags of an abusive personality or, like, things to look out for until I started volunteering at the Willow. Because that's just not something that we teach people, unfortunately. And so, you know, I think there sometimes are red flags, and people just, they don't know because you don't know what you don't know. And we don't talk about them. We don't talk about domestic violence. And then also, you know, on the other hand, some abusers are really good at hiding their abusive behavior. So early on in the relationship, you know, things might look really great, and, you know, they might be very kind and loving and, you know, even charismatic. So if you look at it from that perspective, like, it's no wonder that somebody would fall in love with them or enter a relationship with them. And it's not until that abuser knows that, okay, well, now I've got this person, I've got some power over them, they're invested in the relationship, that they typically start actually being abusive.
And I believe a lot of the times they start to try and undermine relationships with friends and family so that the person becomes more alone and doesn't get second opinions.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. Isolation, I would say, from having worked with quite a few survivors when I was doing, you know, sort of direct service work in our shelter, isolation was a part of nearly every abusive relationship that I heard about to some degree. You know, all abusive relationships look different, of course, but, you know, sometimes it was really extreme, like, you know, leaving the survivor at home in the middle of the country, you know, sort of rural area with no phone, no keys, you know, no way to get away, nearest neighbor is miles away type thing. And so sometimes it can take on really extreme things like that. But then other times isolation can be a lot more subtle, to where the survivor doesn't necessarily even realize it's happening. Like maybe the abusive person is saying to them, you know, I know you're supposed to go hang out with your friends tonight, but you know what? I just want to spend time with you. Like, I love you so much. You spend so much time with your friends. And, you know, maybe if that's a one-time thing, they really just want to spend some time with their partner. But if it becomes a repeated pattern of behavior, you know, maybe over time they stop hanging out with their friends altogether, you know, or every time they talk to their family, they get into a fight with their abuser because their abuser says, well, you know, I really don't like your mother, for instance, because she just doesn't like me. And so it just becomes easier not to talk to those people because the fight doesn't seem worth it. And then before you know it, when the abuse starts to really escalate, you don't have anywhere to turn to.
And I think one of the big questions that I hear from people who are learning about domestic violence or maybe want to understand but don't totally understand the dynamics is that question of, and I'm sure you know what I'm going to say, is why doesn't she just leave?
Yeah.
And so I was wondering if you could just talk about some of the barriers to leaving a relationship that is abusive.
Absolutely. So particularly, I think, when people are living together and they have a shared residence and the relationship is abusive, that makes it really difficult to leave because the second leading cause of homelessness in the United States is domestic violence. So there are a lot of people that are on the streets or in homeless shelters because, you know, they tried to leave their abusive partner and they didn't have anywhere else to go. And then if you add to that the very real possibility that, you know, maybe they share children with their partner as well, and now it's a choice between staying with their partner or potentially going to a shelter that they know nothing about, which can be really scary, or sleeping in their car with their kids. You know, at least if they stay, they know what's going to happen. There's some predictability there, and at least they're in their own home. So that's an incredibly difficult choice for people to make. There's also usually a pretty high level of financial abuse in these kinds of relationships. So, you know, if the abusive partner is the only one that has access to all of the finances and the bank accounts, you know, that's another barrier to them leaving. Financial abuse might also look like, you know, the abusive person has not let the survivor or the victim work in a long time, even if they wanted to. And so maybe now it's going to be really difficult for them to find a job and support themselves. Not to mention, you know, they might still love that person. And, you know, a lot of times people kind of scoff at that, like, well, you know, how can you love this person that is hurting you? But, you know, you have to remember that that person is not always being abusive. There is this other side to them that they sometimes show the survivor, and that's that person they fell in love with. And then finally, of course, and there's so many other reasons, definitely, but I think a really important one to mention as well is that, like I said before, it's really dangerous to leave an abuser. That is the most likely time to be murdered. So I think a lot of times people say, you know, well, hey, you know, this person's going to kill you if you don't leave, not realizing that leaving could actually be the thing that triggers the abuser to kill them. That's the most dangerous time. So it's very hard to leave.
Absolutely. That loss of power and control they're trying to exert over that person when they're trying to relieve that relationship, they're feeling that loss of control, and that's when...
Definitely.
And I know at least one of the local shelters has also built a pet shelter because people are afraid of leaving their pets alone because the person might take it out on them or they might have previously threatened them.
Absolutely. You know, that... I think you may be referring to Rosebrook, perhaps.
I believe they have a pet shelter.
Really great facility. And yes, that's a huge barrier for survivors. It's, you know, I've met with lots of people who their abuser has threatened to hurt or kill their pet. And then some people who, unfortunately, their abuser did hurt or kill their pet when they left. And, you know, I totally understand that. I'm an animal lover myself, and I could never leave my pets if I knew that something bad was going to happen to them. You know, pets become parts of our family. And then you add this other layer, I think, when you're talking about rural domestic violence, because then sometimes folks will have farm animals like horses and things as well. And that's an additional barrier because that abuser might still very well harm or kill one of those animals. And, you know, you can't bring, like, a horse to a shelter. So that's definitely an added barrier.
Along with, you know, the barriers you're talking about with rural living, I would imagine that some of the folks that you serve outside of Lawrence and Douglas County and in Franklin and Jefferson County face some unique barriers from being in a rural community.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Definitely. So I think I mentioned before that a lot of times, and when you're living in a rural area, there might be quite a bit of distance between you and your neighbors. So it makes it less likely that the police are going to be called, for instance, if there's a loud violent incident, because there may just not be anyone around that can hear. So a lot of times when you're talking about rural domestic violence, the domestic violence on average tends to be more physically severe and to go on undetected for longer. And again, when we were talking about that isolation of survivors, the perfect way, I think, to isolate someone is to move them out to the country. So that's very intentional on the part of the abuser.
And poverty levels tend to be higher in rural areas as well, so it'd be even harder to try and find some funds to help you make an initial getaway.
Absolutely.
I'm listening to this, and I'm thinking, is there a diagnosis for the type of man who would abuse, or I suppose you could say woman, although I find that laughable because I was abused, and I would have never struck a man because I know I wouldn't be able to stand up in a fight if I started it. So, but is there a disorder or personality type that can be identified in an abuser?
Yeah, that's a good question. So we do work with male survivors as well. And while, you know, women definitely experience lethal domestic violence at much higher rates than men, you know, we do see male survivors that are being abused by women, and we also see survivors of other gender identities too, you know, non-binary, transgender, et cetera, that are also experiencing violence. But as to the question about whether there's like a specific personality disorder, you know, we have a collection of traits or red flags that we know can expose a potential abuser. It doesn't always work. Like I said, sometimes abusers are really good at hiding their behavior, at least for a period of time. But there are sort of different, I guess, types of abusers. And so, you know, but there's no like one specific kind that like always exists, that's the person who abuses. Because abusers, just like the rest of us, they are human beings. And so they are all different to some extent. I think the red flags are really useful, you know, knowing the warning signs. Those do tend to be pretty universal. But like I said, the abusers themselves, they tend to be different. You can sort of put them into different categories of abusers. Like one that I think is particularly relevant to this conversation is something that's called a survival-based batterer. And that's that kind of abuser that is most likely to murder his family and then himself. And I'm using the gendered, you know, he in this situation because this does typically tend to be a male abuser. And that, like, kind of, if you're looking at the types there, that survival-based, the reason it's called that is because that type of abuser tends to be the kind that says things like, you know, I just can't live without you. I'd rather die than have, you know, to go on without you. If, you know, I can't have you, no one can. Those kinds of things tend to be indicative of a survival-based batterer, someone who's most likely to murder.
Another issue, I think, that someone brought up earlier when we began this conversation is how the woman's confidence is eroded by the batterer, and how she's convinced that she is worthless. And for myself, I was married to an alcoholic, and by the time he hit me, I mean, it was, you know, the verbal abuse and the mental abuse had already convinced me that I was short in some way. I wasn't skinny enough. I wasn't pretty enough. I wasn't smart enough. I used to think that if only I could be smarter. If only I were prettier. If only, you know, this wouldn't be happening to me. And then you become ashamed, and you don't want anybody to know because you're ashamed.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, first of all, thank you so much for hearing that, and I'm so sorry that you experienced that. But yeah, you're definitely right. I've never worked with a survivor that didn't have some level of, you know, emotional and psychological abuse going on. You know, not all domestic violence survivors experience physical abuse, but psychological and emotional abuse is pretty common. And, you know, it is that sort of slow tearing down of somebody's self-esteem. I think a lot of people assume that all domestic violence survivors, you know, the only reason that they are in a violent relationship is because, well, they must have had a low self-esteem to be with that person. But that's just not the case. There are plenty of confident people who go into these relationships, but by the end, their abuser has on purpose systematically torn down their self-esteem so that they do have that power over them and they can control them more easily, and so that they do feel like no one will believe them. You know, I think of it like if, you know, your partner tells you that you're stupid, you know, if it happens one time, you might say, well, no, I'm not. Like, what's wrong with you? How can you say that to me? But if every single day, or if just kind of peppered throughout your relationship, they continually bring that up to you, they continually make you feel stupid, you're going to start to believe it.
Our guest today is Alicia Cassano-Weisenbach with the Willow Domestic Violence Center in Lawrence, Kansas. And Alicia, give us that website again, how they can get there.
So our website is www.willowdvcenter.org, and the DV as in domestic violence. And you can access services through there. You can find our hotline number, and it's answered 24/7, 365 days a year. You can volunteer through there. So that's a really good point of contact to use.
I'm kind of thinking maybe we should try to open our one phone line that we have left to see if anyone would like to call in. This is kind of throwing something out here that we hadn't talked about, but we've had a show some time back when a woman called in, and it seemed to be very important to her to be able to share her experience. So I thought maybe there's somebody out there that would like to share or add something to this conversation. And that number to call is 816-931-5534, 816-931-5534, if you would like to call in and make a comment or share an experience that you've had.
And because we know that about 1 in 3 women and 1 in 7 men are affected by domestic violence, we just wanted to share not only the Willow hotline number, but also the National Domestic Violence Hotline number, if you're listening outside of the service counties for Willow. The Willow number is 1-800-770-3030. And the National Domestic Violence Hotline number is 1-800-799-7233. And they provide assistance 24/7.
And that number, if you want to call in, is 816-931-5534. Alicia, is there anything else you can share with us? Any important tips or anything you can think of that would be helpful to a volunteer, someone interested in volunteering, or to a woman out there listening who is in the middle of a domestic violence situation?
Sure. So for people who might be interested in volunteering with us or another domestic violence center, I would just say, you know, you don't necessarily have to have any special skills. Usually they'll train you on everything you need to know. And there's lots of different ways you can help out. It might not be that you feel like answering a crisis hotline is a good fit for you. But maybe you can help with community education, or you can come by and do some office work. So there's so many different ways to get involved, even if that sort of peer counseling side where you're talking directly to survivors doesn't sound like something that'd be a good fit. But I can promise you from my own experience that volunteering for a domestic violence center is the most rewarding thing I think that you can do. And then I would say to survivors that might be listening, anyone experiencing violence, that, you know, we believe you and that there's help out there for you. And you can call the national hotline or us anytime.
Given that you said that you have men and women who have experienced domestic violence and mm-hmm. people that are non-binary identities or transgender identities, how do you handle that within a shelter when you might have women who are petrified of all men for a while until they handle that trauma, and there might also be men in there who are suffering from similar trauma?
Yeah, I think that's a really good question. You know, in our shelter, we do have different rooms, and all of our bathrooms are like single-use bathrooms, so they're private. So, you know, we do, of course, we know we're not going to put, you know, a man and a woman together, because that could be really triggering for someone, and then also for privacy reasons, of course. But, you know, that was a big worry we had when we first integrated our shelter is, you know, are the women that are using our services going to be, you know, really triggered? Are they going to, you know, possibly not want to come because of this? And I was actually working in the shelter at the time. And so I sat down, we have house meetings every week, and I sat down with the residents at the time to talk to them about the fact that we were going to become integrated. And I was really worried about how they were going to react. And, you know, they just kind of said, yeah, no, we get it. Like, men can totally experience violence too, you know? And they were not worried about it. It was us who was worried about it, the people, I think, in the movement who were assuming that this was going to be a big problem for the people we were serving. But at least in my experience, they weren't the ones who had a problem with it at all.
I was actually working at a domestic violence shelter when I believe it was when the Violence Against Women Act was reauthorized a couple of years mm-hmm. ago, and they basically said, you know, you can't have separate but equal services, which is what a lot of shelters were doing out of necessity at the time, but you have to have right. integrated services in the same space. And there was no guidance. There was no additional funding that was given yeah. to shelters. It was just, all right, it's a new day. You have to start doing this. And so, but it sounds like from, you know, what you've said from survivors is that it's been easier than anticipated.
Definitely. And I remember when that happened as well. I was also you know, working in domestic violence, and it was scary, and it did kind of feel like, okay, this is a great unknown for us. What's going to happen? And we sort of had all these worries about what could happen, and, you know, sort of catastrophizing in our mind, like, these terrible scenarios that could play out, and it was okay.
Yeah, I don't think anybody wanted to see anybody go unserved. It was just the unknown territory, and that it could possibly be dangerous for individuals who are non-binary or even right. transgender women in shelters.
Well, and I think we were a little bit unique in that we have been serving transgender women in the shelter for years.
Yeah.
And so it was just a matter for us of extending the services to people who were male identified. But yeah, it was a great unknown. But I'm so glad that we did it, because now we've been able to offer, you know, safe shelter to people who need it.
Absolutely.
I wonder if it's because with domestic violence, it's always been someone that they know, so they're not necessarily afraid of strangers, whereas it often a rape victim, it would be some strange male or strange female that raped them. So perhaps it was less of an issue in a domestic violence shelter.
Yeah, perhaps. I don't know for sure, but that definitely could be.
Did you want to say something?
Yes.
Okay. We have you don't know who's all in the studio here, Alicia. We have Una Nowling, engineer, Fiona Nowling with the English accent, Ember, who's a domestic violence worker, and a brand new trainee to us today, Janae Davis. And she, I think, would like to say something.
Oh, great. Yes.
Okay, so my curiosity, comes more into more younger women who may have be brand new in relationships or dealing with love in general. And I know you said that domestic abuse doesn't always result to physical violence. So mm-hmm. what are the early signs of the emotional abuse, the psychological abuse, where it's more toward, it may be verbal? I know a lot of times younger generations deal with whether it's joking or whether they're playing around, but how do they pick up on signs of what's actually signs of abuse, for letter on that a line, in long-term situations?
Yeah, I think that's a really good question. So I think particularly, you know, what I would want to tell young people is that if something doesn't feel right about it, even if that person says, oh, you know, why are you making such a big deal of it? I'm just kidding. But if it didn't feel like kidding to you, it didn't feel right, you felt a lack of respect from your partner, from your boyfriend, from your girlfriend, that is a red flag. And you should trust yourself. And I know society, you know, tells us a lot, like, to not trust our instincts. I think particularly women. You know, you're being crazy, you're being hysterical is what we're told, but your instincts are really important. So if when somebody says something to you, even if they're saying that it's a joke, if it doesn't feel right to you, it's not right.
Okay. And then thank you for that. And then also to add on to that, what would your advice be for even friends and family who have witnessed that in young relationships, and how can they have a part in helping the situation or helping the individuals?
Sorry, just for clarification. So like a friend or a family member of a young person who is witnessing the young person experiencing abuse?
Yes.
Okay. I think my advice would be pretty much the same as to adults supporting people experiencing abuse, which is, you know, believe what they're telling you about the situation. Know that they might not be ready to leave that relationship. And try not to give them a directive like, you just need to break up with that person. Because one, that even with teen relationships, that can be dangerous. And then also, I think they may resent the people that are trying to help them. And so it kind of drives a wedge between them, and then they're not actually getting support.
And I would have thought a lot of the time parents tend to disapprove of young people's relationships anyway. I know they did when I was young. So you'd automatically just assume that they were being fuddy-duddies and they never like any of my boyfriends or girlfriends anyway. So it's just more of the same.
Oh, sure. Yeah. I can remember, you know, I have a few siblings, and I can remember one of my siblings, the people that she was dating, you know, and my mom going, "Oh, no, about those people, I don't like them." And the very, very natural reaction was, "Well, what do you know? You know, you're just being kind of an old fuddy-duddy, like you said." So I think that's a really natural response for someone who's young to have. And so knowing that if you come at it really aggressively, like, "I don't like the way this person is talking to you, you know, you need to break up with them," they're probably going to ignore you.
I think, too, with young people, there's a lot of use of, you know, messaging apps, Snapchat, phones, things like that, that maybe those of us in this room didn't have when we were growing up, when we were in middle school and high school. And so, you know, there's all these new rules and figuring out what's normal and what's not. And sometimes when I'm talking to younger people, they're like, "Oh, my boyfriend looks through my messages. It's fine."
Yeah.
And I'm like, "Well, actually, you know, this could be a sign of, you know, he's monitoring you, trying to figure out where you're going, or she's checking whose girls you're commenting on their Instagrams and things like that, that I see on TV that I'm guessing are reflective of real high school experiences. I'm not sure. And so I think that that's a good point in conversation, too, that a lot of parents may not be equipped to have, because they're just not, they don't know what happens on Snapchat or Instagram.
Right. Yeah, they're not familiar always even with the technology. And so you're totally right. It makes it really hard to have a conversation that is meaningful if, one, you have no idea what they're doing on all of these platforms, and then, two, you might not fully understand the technology because maybe you just don't use it because those kinds of apps are geared towards a younger demographic.
And some of them are geared towards not having a lasting record of the conversation as well. So
right.
You can't even show it to someone and say, "This seemed a bit off to me."
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. Particularly like Snapchat is probably the biggest one like that, where, you know, you can set the amount of time that someone can view the photo, and they can take a screenshot and keep it, but it notifies you if they do.
At the Willow, you do have some youth violence prevention programs.
Mm-hmm.
And we know that, you know, the more that kids see violence in their home as kids, the more kind of adverse childhood experiences that they face, the more likely they are to grow up to be abused or to be abusers or to have kind of abusive characteristics or things like that. So what kind of things is the youth violence prevention programs and community education programs you're all doing aimed at notifying the community about?
Yeah, so community education is a huge part of what we do. So we go to local middle schools and high schools, not just in Lawrence, but also, you know, other ones in Douglas County. We go to high schools in Jefferson and Franklin counties as well. You know, we talk to them about healthy dating relationships and things like that. So that's, like I said, that's a big part of what we do as well.
That's great. It's good to get that message out early. And those are messages that those kids can bring home to their families and to their classmates, and teachers can have on their radar in the classroom, too, because we might see behaviors that are not healthy, even in just friendships, platonic relationships, things like that. And it's a point where you can educate students, okay, this is not okay. And then it kind of prevents those behaviors from continuing in the future.
Yes.
Yeah, it's actually one time when I was doing like shelter work and I was answering the crisis hotlines, I actually had a survivor tell me that it was her child who had seen a presentation in her school about domestic violence and healthy relationships that went to her mother and said, you know, mom, I don't think your relationship is healthy. I think it's abusive. And that's why her mother reached out for help.
That's incredible.
And I think teaching kids to speak up about things and to trust their instincts and teaching parents to do that is really important, because I know when we were kids, there was always a relative who would want to give you a kiss and who stank and whatever, and you were told you had to put up with it because they were... But teaching kids to ignore their instincts and to let people pour you and kiss you and stuff when you know that's icky and you don't want to do it starts off at a very early age, teaching people you don't have body autonomy, you have to override those instincts and ignore them because it's polite.
Yeah, definitely.
In Kansas, actually, recently, there were two new laws that went into effect, I believe in May, to help aid victims of domestic violence. And one of them was to lengthen the statute of limitations for victims of sexual crime so that they would apply, they would qualify for crime victim assistance if, say, for instance, years later, their abuser was identified through DNA evidence or something like that. And another one was to increase charges of domestic violence to aggravated battery if strangulation was involved.
Yeah.
And strangulation is one of those big red flags for high lethality relationships. It's something that often goes unreported or, you know, oh, he just grabbed me by the neck, something like that, because people don't realize how serious it is. Has this kind of impacted the work that you all do or the education you've done with survivors?
Yes, to an extent. And, you know, something that we always offer survivors is crime victims' right compensation, which is the fund that you're talking about, can help them with medical costs and therapy and things. You know, not everyone qualifies for it. It depends on a lot of factors, but sometimes, you know, a survivor might not want to do those things, like it requires like cooperation with a police investigation and different things like that, which, you know, for some people, if they are already doing that, it can be a really good resource for them. But yeah, we've always told like the survivors that are coming into our shelter and stuff like that about those programs. And we do a lot of education about domestic violence with survivors as well. So we definitely try to educate them about their rights as far as the law goes.
Absolutely.
Could you perhaps suggest, in case someone is out there listening today and is sitting there saying, that's me, that's my life, are there any recommended safest ways for leaving the relationship and getting to a shelter and getting help, the lowest risk way of getting out of there?
Yeah, that's... So, leaving for most people is always going to be dangerous. So I never want to suggest otherwise. But I think it's really important to have some sort of safety plan in place. And all a safety plan is okay, well, these are my concerns that about my safety. What are some possible, you know, solutions that I can think ahead about in case they arise? And so, like, a really common thing that we tell people is, you know, make sure if you can, if it's safe to do so, get your documents together, like your passport, your license, you know, your medications, things like that that you would need if you had to leave really quickly. You know, we talk to people about the safest place in public that they can, you know, meet with an advocate if they're trying to leave to come into shelter. So we do a lot of safety planning with people, and they can definitely get safety planning services from any domestic violence hotline. And I think that's really important.
Thank you.
I think I've also heard it said, and you will know the answer to this, that on average, a woman will leave three times before she successfully is able to stay away.
Yeah. So I've heard lots of different numbers. The most common one I hear thrown around is seven times.
Oh, wow.
And then when you're looking at different population groups, sometimes it's higher than that. So, it's like we talked about, there are so many barriers to leaving. It's really hard. Sometimes people go back because, you know, they're like, okay, well, I've got children with this person. We've built this whole life together. I'm going to try to make this work. You know, we can go to counseling. And so they may go back and leave a few times, or maybe they go back because they have no other option. They're homeless. Potentially, you know, they feel like their abuser is escalating their behavior, and that they're in real danger if they don't go back.
I think a big misconception that I hear too is that, well, if you leave, you can go to a shelter, but shelters mm-hmm. are often, very often full, especially if you have a lot of children. I've worked with women who've had 5, 6, 7 children, mm-hmm. In a large part because of reproductive coercion, being forced to have children, not being allowed to have access to birth control, or by choice. Yeah. Either way, it doesn't matter. Those children and that woman deserve safety, but they're unable to get it because shelters just don't have space, and they expand shelters and become bigger, and then they're just full again the next day. Is that something that you all experience too?
Yeah, I think that's a very real problem for any type of emergency shelter. And all shelters, you know, they have different average lengths of stays too, based on their right. facilities and kind of how they do their programs. We are like an immediate danger emergency facility. So our typical stay is about 30 days. So our whole thing is, if somebody calls us, and they're in our service area and they're expressing that they're in immediate danger, we will not turn them away. It does not matter how many children they have or if they're by themselves. So sometimes that gets tricky, but we try to make it work.
Figure it out.
Yep.
Well, I would really like to thank you for being on the phone with us today and on the show and helping raise awareness. I'd like you to give us one last leaving thought and perhaps your contact details again. So one last thing for people that need help.
Okay. Sure. So I would just say again, you know, if you need help, there are resources available. And I know that it's really scary to reach out, especially the first time. And the people that pick up that phone, they are going to believe you. We believe you. So if you want help, you know, just know that it's available for whenever you're ready. And then just again, our contact number. So for Douglas, Jefferson, and Franklin counties is 1-800-770-3030.
Thank you, Alicia Cassano-Weisenbach, for being our guest today on Every Woman.
Yes, thank you so much for having me.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. And I'd like to thank my co-hosts today, Ember Obach, and you, when you got to speak for the first time on the radio today, Jeanier Davis. Of course, Sharon Lockhart, my wife, Una Nowling, who was engineering today, and you were listening to Fiona Nowling. This was Every Woman. Please stay tuned for Donna Wolf and for Guess Who's Coming to Kansas City with MC Richardson, and of course, listen in to Every Woman next week. You have been listening to 90.1 FM KKFI Kansas City Community Radio.